Special Counsel Robert Mueller's redacted Russia report. U.S. President Trump is claiming exoneration, but it's not that simple. AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
This morning, the president celebrated what he called a good day.
No collusion, no obstruction.
While Bob Mueller's report does say there's no evidence of a Trump campaign conspiracy with Russia,
the special counsel made clear that he did not exonerate the president.
House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler says there are several examples of Trump attempts to obstruct the investigation. Mueller essentially says aides saved him by refusing to play along and sabotaging the probe. The long-awaited report provides closure in one sense, but also opens a new round of partisan fighting. Democrats are insisting both on seeing Mueller on Capitol Hill and getting his entire unredacted report. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Democratic and Republican lawmakers had sharply differing reactions to Thursday's release of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said Democrats are attacking Attorney General Bill Barr because they won't accept the report's findings.
I trust Bill Barr. I think it's rather laughable to see them turn their guns on him. But that's all they're left with, frankly, is to go after him. It's some kind of ad hominem attack.
Connecticut Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal said that Mueller needs to testify before Congress.
This report is far from the end of the inquiry that this country needs and deserves. It is the beginning of another chapter.
House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler has said that he wants Mueller to testify as soon as possible. Again, Democratic and Republican lawmakers having sharply differing reactions to Thursday's release of the special counsel's report. This is VOA News. In Libya, 2 weeks of attacks continued with mortar shells crashing down on a residential area southwest of the capital of Tripoli Thursday. The attacks in the district of Al Suani occurred a day after 7 people were killed when rockets struck the heavily populated area, which the Libyan National Army, or LNA, led by Commander Khalifa Haftar, has been trying to seize. Some local residents blamed Haftar's forces for the attacks, an accusation the LNA has denied. The violence deepens the chaos that has gripped the North African country since dictator Muammar Gaddafi was toppled in 2011. Tensions continue to escalate between Turkey and the United States over the procurement of Russian missiles. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence warned this month that Turkey's future in NATO could be at risk if Ankara takes delivery of Russian S-400 missiles. It drew an angry response from Turkish presidential spokesman Ibrahim Kalin. Washington claims that the S-400 missiles, which are due to be delivered in July, pose a security threat to NATO military systems in Turkey, in particular America's latest fighter jet, the F-35. Russia is developing the S-400 system to counter the F-35's stealth technology. France Thursday paid a day-long tribute to the firefighters who saved the famed Notre-Dame Cathedral from destruction. French President Emmanuel Macron hailed them as exemplary. They were also made honorary citizens of Paris. We get more from Lisa Bryan reporting from the capital for VOA.
To the music of Bach and words of Victor Hugo, hundreds of Parisians and tourists gathered in front of City Hall Thursday to honor 600 firefighters who battled the Notre Dame inferno. The cathedral loomed just across the Seine River, blackened and crippled, but largely intact.
Il est 2h du matin. Le feu est éteint. Notre-Dame est debout.
Interior Minister Christophe Castaner outlined the arc of the blaze that started Monday evening. He described the massive heat as the firefighters battled the flames. Experts say saving Notre-Dame and its most priceless treasures came down to a matter of minutes. Nobody was killed in the blaze, and key parts of the cathedral, including its bell towers and rose windows, remain intact. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Do the right thing and vote yes. Red signs and banners draped on buildings across Cairo with no noticeable public opposition. The pro-government advertising is calling for constitutional changes that could allow Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to stay in office until 2030. The Egyptians outside the country will begin casting ballots Friday, and voting will begin nationally Saturday, less than a week after Parliament approved the measure. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Friday, April 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudanese protesters were on the move again on Thursday, pushing for more concessions from the military.
Thousands of protesters flooded the streets leading to Sudan's army headquarters, calling for Sudan's transitional military council to allow a swift return to civilian rule.
That's reported now by Mujahideen in Khartoum. Both the South Sudan government and the opposition want a delay in forming a new government. Six students who drew pictures on President Pierre Nkurunziza's photo in their textbook remain expelled from school. And Zimbabwe's government calls for exhuming the bodies of Mugabe-era genocide victims.
Unless they admit that they were there and they apologize, there is no way the community will accept their authority to exhume the bodies.
Rejoice Mugwenya is a Zimbabwe political analyst. The ILO says the changing world of work poses new safety and health risks. And a Rwandan albino woman gains fame from a music video. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Sudanese Professionals Association, the group leading the protest that toppled President Omar al-Bashir, held a mass rally on Thursday in the capital, Khartoum. The protesters are demanding that the Transitional Military Council allow for a civilian transitional government. Also, there were reports Thursday that the military had been detaining symbols of Mr. Bashir's regime, including two of his brothers. Naba Mohadi reports from Khartoum.
Thousands of protesters responded to calls by the Sudanese Professionals Association to rally on Thursday in central Khartoum. Protesters flooded the streets leading to Sudan's army headquarters, calling for Sudan's transitional military council to allow a swift return to civilian rule. SVA co-founder Mohamed Naji says they are demanding the military deliver power to the people. He says they called for a civilian presidential council, but with military representation, to fulfill the Sudanese revolution's demands. The SPA has urged all parties to nominate leaders for a civilian transitional council. The demonstrators were divided into groups of doctors, lawyers, journalists, bankers, and engineers. Protesters Muhammad Ahmed is with his doctors' committee. He says they will stay in the sit-in until the revolution's demands are fulfilled, and they won't go back to their homes before this happens. The protesters have been camped in front of army headquarters since April 6, refusing to disperse even after the military said last week it had ousted former President Omar al-Bashir. Sudan's military says it placed Bashir under house arrest, but reports on Wednesday quoted sources saying he had been moved to a federal prison. On Wednesday night, Sudan's military council said it had detained Bashir's brothers, Abdullah and Abbas, as part of efforts to remove symbols of what it called a corrupt regime. The military council announced also the dissolution of security forces loyal to Bashir, saying they would come under the authority of the army and police. Despite the reported arrests, protesters such as Maynou remain skeptical. She says they hear that Bashir is in jail, but they don't want him to be sent to another place. They want a public trial for all crimes he committed in Darfur, says Noor, for the genocide and killing protesters. The council on Monday gave Sudan 15 days to allow a civilian-led transitional government or face suspension in the African Union. Sudan's protests began in December when fuel and food shortages led to price hike and calls for Bashir to step down, and then a military coup that removed him from 3 decades in power. Naba Mujahideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
South Sudan's government says the formation of a national unity government may be delayed since some important tasks in the September peace agreement have yet to be completed. Opposition leader Riek Machar last week called for a postponement of the formation of the new government until security issues are resolved. As Demo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba, South Sudan's information minister says one of the sticking points in the delay is the unresolved issue of the number of states and their borders.
With 3 weeks to go before the transitional government of national unity is supposed to be formed, the government says it wants to consult with other parties to the agreement. South Sudan Information Minister Michael McQueen says the government wants to form a new government by the May deadline stipulated in the peace deal, but doubts it will be met.
So as NPTC, we have asked all the security organs and institutions that are established by the agreement to submit the written progress reports so that we compile all these reports. And then together with our opinion, we call the parties to the agreement and put it before them. If they agree to establish the Artigono, that is fine. The Artigono will be established.
McQueen says it is up to the parties to agree to still form a new government in May or to amend the revitalized peace deal and allow extra time for the parties to complete the task in the agreement. Rebel leader Riek Machar told Reuters while attending a spiritual retreat in Vatican last week, he wants the pre-transitional period to be extended by another 6 months. McQueen says some important bodies, including the Independent Boundary Commission or the IBC, and the Technical Boundary Committee have yet to submit their reports.
That delay also may have an impact on the establishment of the Artigono and the states, because this body is supposed to come up with the number of states, so that we divide the number of states in accordance with the percentages that came in the agreement.
According to the agreement, the IBC was scheduled to complete its work before the end of the pre-transitional period. If it fails to do so, the agreement states the IBC should be transformed into a referendum commission to organize a referendum before the formation of the new government in May. Rajab Mohandis, director of the Juba-based Organization for Responsive Governance, says the parties should delay formation of the new government.
We are concerned that the primary objective of the pre-transitional period, which was to reorganize the security sector in South Sudan into a unified security sector with the forces under a central command, has not been achieved. And in that way, as it stands now, we still have several forces under different commands and militia groups affiliated to these different forces. And these forces combined are a threat to peace under the peace agreement and to the people of South Sudan.
McQueen says the SPLM-IO has made an official request to delay the establishment of the new government. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa agreed on Thursday on a timeline to exhume the bodies of about 20,000 people massacred in the 1980s by former President Robert Mugabe's military during the so-called Operation Gugu Rahundi to wipe out Mr. Mugabe's opponents from the nation's Ndebele ethnic group. President Mnangagwa said this week he was comfortable with a public debate on Gugu Rahundi because he believes it is necessary for progress in the country. Mr. Mnangagwa served as Mr. Mugabe's intelligence chief at the time of the genocide. Zimbabwe political analyst Rejoice Ngwenya says the Ndebele community believes that unless Mr. Mnangagwa admits to his role in the massacre and apologizes, the community will never agree to the exhumation of the bodies.
What the community in Matabeleland is saying is that before the perpetrators have been brought to justice and before the perpetrators have accepted responsibility over these crimes, it is not possible for the community to allow them to do that. There is a lot of conflict around whether or not this government is the right institution since there are perpetrators that are in high office.
When you talk about since there are perpetrators that are in high office, there's a suggestion that the current president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, was also part of the Mugabe government and must have also known or played a part. Is that the feeling there?
It is not just a feeling, but there is empirical evidence. He himself is admitted to that he was a minister responsible for security at that time, but he is refusing to accept responsibility since he says he was a subordinate to Mugabe. There are records that show that he was directly responsible for deploying the soldiers and also the current minister of agriculture. So the whole web of accountability revolves around Mnangagwa and Perrin Tshiri. And this is why the community is saying unless they admit that they were there and they apologize, there is no way the community will accept their authority to exhume the bodies.
But President Mnangagwa earlier this week said that he was comfortable with the public debate on this massacre, because he said it's necessary for progress given what is going on in the country.
This is where the paradox and the hypocrisy comes in. Now, the first step towards reconciliation as far as the people of Matabele and discontent is first of all to accept responsibility over Gukurahundi. And once that responsibility is accepted, then the perpetrators must then be brought to justice. Now, earlier on in his presidential career, a year ago, he was even disputing the numbers that were being bended around. So apparently we are dealing with an individual who is not accepting responsibility.
Rejoice, the issue of tribal affiliation is not that far from African politics. To what degree is this massacre playing in Zimbabwe politics? For example, the Shona and the Ndebele. Is there any tension between these two ethnic groups?
This is where the tragedy comes alive in terms of its contradictions. When we are talking about reconciliation and compensation, there must be an acceptance, first of all, that the Shona-controlled army, the 5th Brigade, was deployed as a way of inflicting revenge and genocide on the people of Matabele. So basically, you are right. It's a tribal issue, and there must be individuals that should accept that angle. Otherwise, this whole debate and dialogue comes to nothing.
Rejoice Mungwenya is a Zimbabwe political analyst. He was speaking with me from the capital, Harare. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Friday, April 19th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Six schoolgirls and a boy who were detained after drawing pictures on the photograph of Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza in their textbooks have been released from prison, but they remain expelled from their schools. Louise March, Human Rights Watch's Central Africa director, told Ricky Shryak the students' case demonstrates the ongoing clampdown on freedom of expression in Burundi.
First of all, this never should have happened in the first place. Arresting children for defacing the image of the president in a school book. It's only not funny because of how serious the accusations were for insulting the head of the state and the potential prison term that they could have carried and they could still carry. It's important to note the charges haven't been dropped. They've just been released from prison. There's a difference between the two. But more importantly, I mean, we're talking about, this is not happening in the capital, Bujumbura. This is happening outside. This is in Kirundo. And we're talking about swaths of the Burundian population who are among some of the most vulnerable people in the world. This is a terribly poor country. And as any expert in development will tell you, one of the key means of enabling yourself and doing better and ensuring a type of better future is via education. So preventing these children from getting the education that they deserve, but also that they so desperately need, really almost is the major tragedy here. I mean, it's just really ensuring that these kids are going to be paying for this act, this trivial act, for the rest of their lives.
This isn't the first time it's happened in Burundi. Is that correct, that school children have been jailed and expelled for offenses like this?
No, you're absolutely right. This is a type of a petty punishment that we've seen as recently as 2016. The fact is that ever since 2015, when the political crisis in Burundi really developed, when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he was going to seek this controversial third term, and now with changes to the constitution, with this referendum, the fact is that we've seen a real crackdown on any type of dissent, which includes these school children who obviously school administrators view they're doodling and scribbling as a sign of dissent, as a sign of being against the ruling party.
That was Louise March, a Central Africa director for Human Rights Watch. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from New York. A UN agency says existing methods of protecting workers from accidents and disease are not good enough to deal with new occupational hazards arising from changes in the nature of work. The International Labour Organization is calling for revisions to address physical and psychological problems stemming from the changing job world. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, where the report was released.
Recent ILO estimates find 2.78 million workers die from occupational accidents and work-related diseases each year. It says more than 374 million people are injured or fall ill every year through work-related accidents. The cost to the world economy from work days lost is nearly 4% of global gross domestic product. The ILO's report warns the changes and dangers posed by an increase in technology could result in a worsening of that situation. It says new measures must be implemented to deal with the psychosocial risks, work-related stress, and non-communicable diseases resulting from new forms of work. It says digitization, artificial intelligence, robotics, and automatization requires new monitoring methods to protect workers. Manal Azee is an ILO technical specialist on occupational safety and health. She tells VOA surveillance of workers has become more intrusive, leading them to work longer hours, a situation that may not be ethical.
Also different monitoring systems that workers wear. Before you would punch in, punch out. Now you could wear bands on your wrist that show how many hours you're actually working in a production line. And there's even discussion of introducing implants where workers can be continuously surveyed on their production processes.
Azee says a host of mental problems could be introduced by new work environments. The report also focuses on changes in demographics. It says employers have to adapt to the physical needs of older workers who may need training to safely operate equipment. In the past, creating a safer working environment focused on the prevention of risks. Authors of the report say the ILO today needs to anticipate the risks. Before young people apply for a job, they say they should know their rights. The power of knowledge, they say, will help protect employees in the workplace. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A Rwandan albino woman has appeared in a music video attracting widespread attention and helping alleviate the stigma of albinos in Africa. Eugene Uwimana has more from Kayonza in eastern Rwanda.
Claudine Mukabsine is a 28-year-old graduate from the University of Rwanda with albinism, a genetic condition that makes her hair, skin, and eyes pale. In parts of Africa, albino body parts are considered to have black magic that brings luck and wealth. Their graves are dug up and the bodies stolen, while the living face constant fear of abduction and murder. But here in Rwanda, Mukarusine has become famous. She shows a reporter a music video by rhythm and blues singer James Ruhumuriza, known as King James, which she acted in. The music video for the song called Igitekerezo, meaning ideas, shows King James serenading Mukarusine in the city and countryside. In Rwanda, it has gone viral. She says this video played a very big role in her life because many people have come to realize that people with albinism can do something that is good and appreciated. The United Nations says nearly 100 albinos were killed in Tanzania alone in the past 2 decades. For Mukarusine, the song released in January is a spark of light in her dark days of fear that she too could be killed for being albino. She says on the first day she heard about this threat, she cried the whole day in class. She used to worry so much, wondering if she's going to die, but she couldn't share her sorrow with anyone, says Mukarusine, and it affected her studies. Rhythm and blues singer King James says he composed the song after watching accounts of albinos being killed in Rwanda's neighboring countries.
That's when I decided that I can feature her so that I can give a good message to people that even if they are albinos, but they can do anything that we can do, they can do anything they want to do.
Mukarusine works as a mentor at the National Union of Disability Organizations of Rwanda. She helps 3 groups of 300 people learn about saving money and accessing finance. She has hope and confidence that her future will be good and she will have a family. Eugene Uimana for VOA News, Kayonza, Gwanda.
Five minutes past the hour, time out for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports in Ethiopia, where German Bundesliga side Bayern Munich have opened their first football school in Africa with a new facility located in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. The reigning Bundesliga champions announced that they had signed a deal with the Ethiopian Football Federation, launching a partnership which will involve coaching exchanges and the development of local players. The club have launched similar projects in Singapore, China, Thailand, Japan, and the United States in recent years, but this is the first of such schools they have opened in Africa. And now to the under 17 African Cup of Nations, where Guinea came from behind to beat Senegal 2-1 in their Group B match day 2 on Thursday evening at the Samaji Stadium, few miles outside Dar es Salaam city, to boost their chances of a place at the next round of the Total African Cup of Nations under 17 Tanzania 2019. The results ensured Cameroon went through, joining Nigeria as the two teams to have qualified for the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Brazil later in the year. Cameroon leads the pack on 6 points, Guinea on 3 points, with Morocco and Senegal in that order with just a point each. And to Ghana, where Ghana's final squad for the upcoming African Cup of Nations is almost decided, according to head coach James Kwesi Appiah. Huge interest continues to follow the naming of the 23 men who will be tasked to win the title to end a sprawling 37-year title drought for the West African nation. A provisional squad is expected to be unveiled in May, with the final team to be named in June. The Black Stars of Ghana have been drawn in Group F, which also include five-time champions and cup holders Cameroon, Benin Republic, and Guinea-Bissau. The South African Football Association, SAFA, met the April 16th deadline to submit their bidding registration to FIFA for the hosting of the 2023 Women's World Cup. They will compete against 8 other nations who have also expressed their interest to host the Global Women's Tournament. The 2019 edition of the Southern Africa Regional Cup competition, the CASAFA Cup, will be staged in the South African coastal city of Durban from May 25th to June the 8th, serving as vital preparations for the region's African Cup of Nations bound teams. The prestigious regional tournament will be hosted in partnership with the South African Football Association and the Ithekwini municipality, with venues around the city to enrich the 14-team competition. The 2019 CASAFA Cup will be the first of 6 tournaments scheduled to be hosted by the regional body this year. And that does it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Mortar shells crashed down on a residential area southwest of the Libyan capital of Tripoli on Thursday, a continuation of 2 weeks of clashes between UN-backed government forces and the Eastern Libyan National Army. The attacks in the district of Al-Suwani occurred 1 day after 7 people were killed when rockets struck the heavily populated area. That is it for this Friday, April 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very good weekend.
It's Legendary Beats.
Hello and welcome to the weekend. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Do you have a song that you just love that's about an African city or neighborhood? Well, this Sunday's edition features a full playlist of exactly that. Plus, one of Africa's best young live bands joins us on air all hour long. Makumba.
Makumba is a 6-piece band from Victoria Falls. Makumba.
Yes, the award-winning group from Victoria Falls, Zimbabwe, hangs out throughout the show, and they perform Song of the Week live. want to miss this. It's going to be awesome. So tune in this Sunday, 15:05 and 20:05 Universal Time.